Hey, it's Mike McEntee. Happy Wednesday to you. We have another theme show today. Today's theme is attempting to do what people think might be impossible, such as winning in a district that Democrats haven't won in ages, or perhaps passing gun violence prevention legislation in Minnesota. There is a possible breakthrough on gun violence protection bills at the legislature.
And the polling shows this is not a partisan issue at all. You know, death is not a partisan issue. You know, if you're a victim, they don't usually ask first, what's your political party affiliation?
Yeah, the partisanship here will continue, but Senator Ron Latz has an offer to offer a gun background check amendment tomorrow that might actually have a chance with the Republican majority. This after Representative Aaron May Quaid staged a 24-hour sit-in on the House floor to get some movement on the issue. And the House Speaker, Kurt Dowd, says it's possible something might happen. But first, if you're hoping the Supreme Court will stop what President Donald Trump once described as his Muslim ban, that you should dial back your hopes maybe just a little bit. At least that's what many court observers thought after watching the High Court hear Trump versus Hawaii today. Joining us now is one of those observers, the Justice Editor for Think Progress, Ian Millhiser. Ian, welcome to the program.
It's good to be back. Thanks so much.
Good to have you on. So remind us what this case is, because we've heard so many different cases here, as the Muslim ban has progressed. What is this case and what are the issues?
Sure. So I think it helps to go back to Trump when he was still a candidate. I mean, more than a year before the election, he was talking about how he wanted to ban all Muslims from entering the United States, at least temporarily. And then somewhere along the way, I think his lawyers got to him and said, hey guy, you can't say that. That's unconstitutional. And so he was quite explicit about, like, his workaround. He then said, well, you know, they don't like it when I say Muslim ban. So instead, I'm going to talk about territories. And I'm going to say, like, there's certain countries we should ban. And of course, they're all majority Muslim countries, rather than actually calling it a Muslim ban. And sure enough, he did exactly what he said he was going to do. He picked a group of six majority Muslim countries. He said, originally, I think it was a list of seven. He said that he's not going to allow people from these countries to enter the United States. And since then, there's been multiple versions of the ban. There's been attempts to, they've changed the names of the countries that are on the list. But the question here is whether when Donald Trump said, I am going to do a Muslim ban, and the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to pick some majority Muslim countries and not let people from those countries come to the United States, whether you actually believe what he said with his own words.
So were the justices buying that today? How did that figure into the arguments?
So here's the thing about this case, is that the divide really wasn't on the law. Like, I mean, I don't know that there's that much disagreement about, like, the question of whether or not the president is allowed to just target a particular faith. Where the disagreement was really on the court is how the individual justices feel about Donald Trump. So if
really?
You think that this is this erratic guy who, you know, said he was going to do this Muslim ban, described how he was going to do it, and did it, and we shouldn't trust him when he then turns around later and says, oh, no, but this was really about national security. You know, there were four justices who seemed to be in that camp, and they were inclined to strike the ban down. And then there were four justices who seemed likely to say, oh, no, this isn't actually a Muslim ban. This is the president and his cabinet got together, and they just decide that people from these countries are dangerous, and so for national security reasons, we need to block them. And somewhere in the middle is Justice Kennedy. But, you know, really what's so odd about this case is it's more the justices voting about on whether or not they trust the word of Donald Trump than it is them voting on, like, you know, a difficult legal, you know, not especially difficult legal question, whether or not the government of the United States is allowed to target Muslims.
So Justice Kennedy, what's the feeling? Is he trusting Donald Trump? I mean, it's always hard to tell. The justices just asked question. What was his line of questioning on this?
I mean, he, as he often does, asked questions of both sides. You know, he did say, you know, at one point to the Trump administration lawyer, well, you know, if there was a mayor and the mayor said all sorts of vituperative things about a group and then acted upon it, we wouldn't just say, oh, well, we're going to ignore all their statements. But then he seemed to agree with Justice Alito, who's really conservative, that, you know, well, this is a national security matter and the president needs to be able to act and it shouldn't be up to the courts to make these decisions because they don't know what they're doing. And, you know, what struck me about Kennedy's behavior is he didn't seem especially bothered by what Trump is doing. And Kennedy's a guy who, like, often loses his temper on the bench. Like, often the way you can tell how Justice Kennedy is going to vote is he gets really upset at the side that he thinks is going to lose. And so he was not acting like someone who thinks that this is an abnormal president who has done something, you know, outlandish and egregious here. You know, he was speaking like someone who thinks this is a fairly ordinary national security case. And I don't think that's good news if you have a problem with the Muslim ban.
So is Kennedy likely the deciding vote? Are there any other wild cards on the court here, justices who might not go the way you expect because of some other reason?
I mean, you would think there would be more justices in play. I mean, Justice Alito, when it's conservative Christians bringing religious liberty cases, has been very, very aggressive in pushing those cases. You know, Chief Justice Roberts did ask one question at the beginning of the oral argument that suggested that he might have some concerns with Lister General's argument, but it was pretty clear pretty quickly that he's likely to vote with Trump. So I think the short answer to this is no. I mean, I think that there are four justices who completely buy the notion this is just an ordinary national security case, and it doesn't matter if the president is Trump, and it doesn't matter that he said all these things when he was a candidate, and it doesn't matter that he's said anti-Muslim things as president. They just want to treat it like an ordinary national security case. And it's troubling. I think that if another president, the Justice Department pointed out that Carter at one point prevented people from Iran from entering the country, that Reagan at one point prevented people from Cuba from entering the country. And ordinarily, like, that's something a president can do. The difference is that Carter didn't campaign on anti-Iranian bias, and Reagan didn't campaign on anti-Cuban bias.
So from your viewpoint right now, it looks like the ban is going to be upheld. Is that what you're thinking?
I think that's more likely than not. I mean, I don't think anyone knows for sure until the opinion comes down. I think that one possibility is Justice Breyer, who's a Clinton appointee, you know, a relatively liberal justice. He seemed to be fishing around for a compromise where the Muslim ban would still stand, but it would be easier for people to get waivers and exemptions from it. And so, you know, like, he was describing situations where, you know, the most egregious case was apparently there was a 10-year-old child with cerebral palsy who wasn't allowed to enter the country. And I think we can be fairly confident that this 10-year-old with cerebral palsy is not a terrorist. You know, he brought up examples of university professors who weren't allowed to meet with their academic colleagues in the United States, of students who aren't allowed to continue studying, of businesses that, you know, find a particularly qualified job applicant from Syria and want to bring the person over and they can't do it. So I think that Breyer was fishing for a compromise that it would at least weaken the Muslim ban in the context of these particularly compelling cases. But one way or another, I think some part of the ban is going to continue to exist.
So maybe if there's a compromise, there might be a way that this ban can be upheld and not be a horrible precedent?
I mean, it's a pretty horrible precedent. I mean, what you have here is you have a president who not only spent more than a year bragging about how he was going to target Muslims because he didn't like their religion, but spent the better part of that year bragging about the pretext, the specific pretext he was going to use to dress up his Muslim ban as if it was actually about something else, as if it was actually about national security. And then when he does exactly what he said he would do, you know, he says, like, that pretext that I put in, that I bragged about doing, here it is. For the Supreme Court to uphold that, I mean, that is extraordinary. I think some people have compared this to the Korematsu case, the Japanese detention case from the 1940s. But, you know, it's not like Roosevelt went around the country bragging about, yeah, I just don't like Japanese people, so I'm going to pretend this is about national security. You know, for the justices to have all of Trump's cards on the table, to know exactly what he's up to and still pretend that he's doing something else, I think would be an extraordinary precedent.
Now, I know we're focused on the Supreme Court, but I wanted to touch briefly on another Trump-related immigration policy case that got a ruling here today. This was the federal judge that ruled today that DACA has to stay in place and the government has to resume accepting new applications. What's the significance here? Is this this is a big deal?
So, this is one of several court decisions that have said that DACA has to keep going. This one was a fairly mild decision. What the judge said, which, I mean, as an abstract matter, is a fairly sensible thing for a judge to do. But what the judge said, if he said, look, I'm going to start a 90-day timer, because what's wrong with what the Trump administration did is they didn't provide a good enough explanation for why they're doing it. And if in 90 days they haven't come up with a good explanation, then, you know, then it's going to be struck down. But all that the Trump administration needs to do, at least to overcome this hurdle, is to come up with an explanation. So I don't know how much this particular decision is going to wind up mattering in the long run. I also would point out that, you know, the pattern we've seen in the Muslim ban cases is the lower courts were really, really skeptical of the Muslim ban, consistently struck it down, and then it gets to the Supreme Court and it looks like it's going to be upheld. And, you know, here again, you've had a number of lower court decisions that were really skeptical of Trump's decision to end DACA. It's going to get up to a really conservative Supreme Court, and I think it is exceedingly unlikely that these cases are going to be upheld before the Supreme Court. So, you know, one way or another, like, this may delay the inevitable, but I think that the way this is ultimately going to play out is that the Supreme Court's controlled by Republicans, and they're likely to say that Trump can get rid of DACA.
We're speaking with Ian Millhiser, the justice editor over at Think Progress. We're talking about court decisions or possible court decisions. The Supreme Court heard another big case today, which was this long-running dispute over congressional and state legislative districts in Texas. It's gerrymandering, this time having to do with discriminating against minority voters. This is the third type of gerrymandering case that's come up before the court, but this one's different than the other ones.
That's right. So, yeah, the two other cases that have gotten a lot of attention are both partisan gerrymandering cases. So those are cases alleging that one party drew the lines in order to give themselves an advantage and to prevent the other party from electing people. This case that was heard yesterday is a racial gerrymandering case. So the allegation is that the lines were drawn in order to disadvantage Black and Latino voters and to give an advantage to white voters. And racial gerrymandering cases have been around for a pretty long time. And based on yesterday's oral argument, I think that there's at least a decent chance that Kennedy crosses over and votes with the liberals and the Texas maps wind up getting struck down. But one thing that I think is important to understand about this case, and this is its second time before the Supreme Court, there's all sorts of procedural complexities to it, but these districts that are being challenged in this case were drawn in 2011. It's now 2018, mm-hmm. And it's very unlikely that the Supreme Court's going to hand down a decision fast enough to implement new maps for the 2018 election. So Texas is going to get to run four elections under these gerrymandered maps. You know, the best case scenario for the challengers is that in 2020, new maps will be in place, and there'll be one election under the new maps before the census happens again, and they have to draw another set of maps anyway. So, you know, what's troubling about this case is that if you're a lawmaker and you're saying, you know, I just don't want Black people to have that much representation. I don't want Latinos to have that much representation. So I'm going to draw a map that screws them. And it's going to take 8 years before the courts get around to striking that map down. And in the meantime, we're going to keep running elections under my racist map. What incentive do you have not to draw a racist map?
True, but this is an important election. Every election is important, but this is the election before the next redistricting.
Right.
And if indeed in Texas they are able to change the maps and that the composition of the legislature changes, I believe it's the legislature in Texas that makes the decisions, wouldn't that theoretically impact things going forward for the next 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree that, like, every election matters and, like, elections before redistricting matter especially. But there has to be a way, you know, it's still a serious problem if you can run three, four, you know, however many elections under illegal maps. And there has to be a way to stop that from happening. There actually used to be a way to stop that from happening. It was called the Voting Rights Act. And the Supreme Court struck down the provision of the Voting Rights Act that was supposed to prevent this kind of thing from happening in the first place.
So the two big cases that we were talking about here before the Supreme Court, the voting rights case here in Texas, and then again the Trump versus Hawaii today, those are big cases. We're probably not going to see the results of those or the decisions until June, is my guess.
Yeah, late June, last week of June is going to be a tough week for those of us who work on the Supreme Court, because you've got those two cases. You've got the big case trying to screw over public sector unions. You've got the Masterpiece Cake Shop case about whether religion is a license to discriminate. You've got the partisan gerrymandering cases. I mean, this is going to be a huge term. And unfortunately, it looks like most of the news is going to be bad.
Yeah. Well, we'll be in contact, I'm sure, between now and June to get some updates from me, Ian. I appreciate you coming in today.
All right. No, thank you so much for chatting.
All right. Ian Melheiser is the justice editor over at Think Progress. You can find what he writes over at thinkprogress.org. Well, coming up next on the show, could Minnesota pass gun violence prevention legislation after all this year? Several indications that the issue is very much alive. We'll talk about it next here on the Mike McEntee Show.
Hello, Richard from Auto Technical. Imagine life without a car, just getting to daycare, then to work on the bus. Do you have a car or truck to donate? We have families waiting for a reconditioned vehicle from Auto Technical. Your gift will change their lives. Remember, we recondition the vehicle so you'll receive a much higher tax deduction. 612-919-5526, autotechnical.org.
Kevin Ross here, inviting you to our brand new store called Ambibulous. What does Ambibulous mean? It means one who enjoys alcoholic beverages of all sorts. Ambibulous is a Minnesota maker's market. Unlike traditional liquor stores, we feature only craft beer, wine, and spirits made here in Minnesota. We are ready to guide your selections, where you can build your own four or six packs. Find us at 949 Hennepin Avenue East in Northeast Minneapolis or online at ambibulousmn.com.
The Spring St. Paul Art Crawl, presented by the St. Paul Art Collective, will be running April 27th, 28th, and 29th. This is a must-do experience that you will love. Over the weekend, you'll have the chance to explore a wide variety of art while touring through local artist studios, lofts, and galleries. Hosting over 350 artists, up for purchase will be paintings, photography, pottery, sculpture, fiber arts, and more. The Art Crawl sprawls over 34 locations. Join the Art Crawl and discover outstanding art for you to own. When you buy local art, you're providing to artists so that they may continue to create the art we love. The Metro Transit is supporting the local art community with free transit passes. Download your pass to ride buses and light rail for free during the Art Crawl. Be sure to get details at the stpaulartcrawl.org. That's the stpaulartcrawl.org.
Hey, welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. About 24 hours ago, we were on the phone here with Erin May Quaid talking about, she's the representative here out of Apple Valley, and she was sitting on the House floor, literally sitting on the House floor, doing a sit-in with about a dozen other legislators, one of them at least a Republican, And the whole point was that they wanted some attention to the fact that there had not been any action on gun violence prevention legislation this year at the session. Specifically, not doing anything about background checks, which a poll just showed that about 90% of the people in Minnesota support doing something about. Well, today she said this is going somewhere. Late in the morning, she ended her 24-hour sit-in at the House floor, where she's been telling stories of victims and survivors of gun violence. Her effort gained a standing ovation at the end of today's House session, which was prompted by Erin Murphy.
Politicians lag behind the power of the voices, the powerful voices of people. And I am grateful for Representative Mae Quaid's willingness to sit in this chamber overnight to give those voices power inside this chamber. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Now, the applause started slowly and then it picked up as people all around the legislature started standing up. And then the camera swung over to Erin Mae Quaid, who had, I guess, some tissues out, and she was looking a little weary, obviously, from being up for so long. But obviously emotional at the moment, but very, very much maybe having caused something to happen. There's a possible word that Speaker Dowd is leaving open the door crack to actually consider something. After the sit-in ended, Dowd made the strongest comments yet, indicating that some form of a gun bill could pass the legislature. He made no promises. He said private talks among legislators as well as pro and anti-gun organizations are taking place. He said that some of the discussions focus on requiring more background checks before guns may be purchased. He said he is involved in some of the talks, but not all of them. Now, on the Senate side, there may be some action tomorrow. Senator Ron Latz has been working behind the scenes to revamp two of his gun violence prevention proposals that he will offer tomorrow as amendments to an omnibus policy bill on the Senate floor. One amendment would extend criminal background checks to most private sales, gun show markets, and online transactions within Minnesota's existing permit-to-purchase program. Latz explained how the gun purchase permit would work.
So some of the concerns I heard at the point of sale transactions, if you want to extend this to the other private transactions, you know, you're driving down the road and you see a garage sale and you want to go in and spontaneously decide to buy something, you can't consummate the purchase if we require point of sale. You'd have, not right away, you'd have to go find a nearby dealer. And there, 90% of Minnesotans live within 10 minutes of a dealer, so it's not... it's not impossible, but it is a barrier to the transaction. And there'd be an additional cost involved in paying the dealer to go through that as well. So this would, you know, someone would make an application just like they would a permit to carry and carry it around with them. So any spontaneous decision to stop and find a firearm that they want to buy, as long as they've got the permit with them and they sign the affidavit that says it's still a valid permit, they're not making any misrepresentations, those kind of things, then, you know, they should be able to buy whatever they want to buy.
As many as they want to buy?
No restrictions on numbers. That was another thing that was considered along the way, and some people have proposed that. Frankly, on my side of the equation on this stuff, have suggested that we do, a permit for each transaction, or a permit for each five transactions, or that permits only last for 30 days or for 60 days. While I respect the attempt to limit access, what I'm most concerned about is the background check and the continuing validity of a background check. And I figure if it's good enough to issue a permit to carry with an annual background check, it's good enough to do that with a permit to purchase as well. It's the same vetting, that would be involved in the permit to carry, the same duration. Again, if law enforcement has any suspicions about someone, they have every right to run a background check on them at any time.
That's Senator Ron Latz describing one of his amendments. The usual it's not germane arguments are probably not going to work on this, because when you offer an amendment on the House floor, that's one of the things that's brought up. It's not germane, meaning that it's not about doesn't go with the bill that we're talking about, because this bill is an omnibus policy bill that is nearly about everything. So it's hard to say that it's not germane. Another thing going forward is Senator Tom Bach, the Senate Minority Leader, is backing this. And Latch says that there might be enough votes to do something here. He says he thinks he's got everybody on the Democratic side. He says that if every Republican district that polled in favor of gun background checks voted yes, it would pass easily. He says that's not going to happen, but there's enough political cover that some Republicans may actually go ahead and vote for this. The other proposal that he has is to allow law enforcement to seek what's called an extreme risk protection order, a court order temporarily restricting a person's access to guns when they show red flags and pose a danger to self or others. He offered a similar proposal earlier this year, didn't go anywhere, but he's retooled it a bit to answer arguments from groups that opposed it. And on top of all of this, Latt says he's not going to accept any other amendments to his bill on things such as banning assault weapons. He wants to keep it pretty surgical on what he's proposed. That's going to happen tomorrow on the Senate floor, and of course, we'll be live streaming the entire session over at theuptake.org. Drop in to watch. Well, coming up next, attempting another seemingly impossible task, winning an election versus an incumbent Republican by the name of Tom Emmer. We'll talk to the man the DFL has picked to do that next here on the show.
The Spring St. Paul Art Crawl, presented by the St. Paul Art Collective, will be running April 27th, 28th, and 29th. This is a must-do experience that you will love. Over the weekend, you'll have the chance to explore a wide variety of art while touring through local artist studios, lofts, and galleries. Hosting over 350 artists, up for purchase will be paintings, photography, pottery, sculpture, fiber arts, and more. The Art Crawl sprawls over 34 locations. Join the Art Crawl and discover outstanding art for you to own. When you buy local art, you're providing to artists so that they may continue to create the art we love. The Metro Transit is supporting the local art community with free transit passes. Download your pass to ride buses and light rail for free during the Art Crawl. Be sure to get details at the stpaulartcrawl.org. That's the stpaulartcrawl.org.
Real estate is one of the biggest financial transactions most people ever make. So keep informed. Tune in each week as Bricks Real Estate presents the Twin Cities Real Estate Show, Sundays starting at noon. Kirk Duckwall, Chad Vandelot, and Brian Durham, the House Geeks, will keep you up to date with industry-leading guests, stats, and local market trends. Again, you can catch them Sundays starting at noon on this station or online anytime through the House Geeks Facebook page.
Minnesota is home to the only major institution in North America devoted to Russian art, history, and culture. The Museum of Russian Art, located off 35W on Diamond Lake Road in South Minneapolis, can be your personal connection to extraordinary artists, stories, and context. We offer more exhibitions and events than ever before, from concerts and lectures to vodka tastings and more. Open daily, free parking, and a great Groupon deal. Find out more at tmora.org.
Welcome back to the Mike McIntyre Show here on AM 950. This past weekend, Ian Todd got the unanimous acclamation endorsement of the DFL for the 6th Congressional District race. His next task, though, is probably going to be a little bit more divided and much tougher. Joining me now is the newly endorsed DFL candidate for Congress, Ian Todd. Ian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me back.
Good to have you back. It's been a few months since we last had you on the program. You've been out on the campaign trail. Obviously, you convinced enough Democrats to support you that you got the endorsement. What have you learned from this whole process?
Oh, man, if there's one thing that I've learned from CD6, it's that we have an incredible fighting chance. 2018 is a new year, and certainly we haven't done that well in years prior, but, you know, I don't think that it's impossible anymore, and I don't think the people here in CD6 think it's impossible anymore either.
What is leading you to believe that? Because I'll just bring up the statistics here so people know what we're talking about. Tom Emmer, won with 65% of the vote over Democrat David Snyder in that the last time they had an election there. And Emmer's been winning. Bachman's been winning that district as long as I can remember. So why are people suddenly optimistic?
Well, I think it has to do with the same reason that everyone's saying that there's a blue wave going on. You know, certainly it has to do with our current president, obviously, but it's more to do with just kind of waking up to the kind of policies that we get under Republicans. We don't want that anymore. People in CD6 don't want that anymore, and they're certainly seeing the damage, you know, especially while they're doing their taxes this year and all finding out what it's going to be like when they file again next year.
So, I mean, you mentioned tax policies. Obviously, not everybody is getting as big a tax break as they thought they might. Some people are actually paying more. Most of that tax break went to the rich people here in the United States. Beyond that, what are people saying to you? Yeah, this is what's got me thinking. I've got to vote for Ian Todd this time around instead of Tom Emmer.
Well, I think they like the message that I share about getting the money out of politics. You know, I'm not the least bit afraid to say that there is corruption in Washington, and we have to deal with that. You know, I think a lot of times people skirt the edges of that, but I'm a candidate that's not willing to take any of that corporate PAC money. I'm willing to, you know, earn this purely through people's trust and what people are willing to give me from CD6. So it's a little bit of a different type of campaign. It's honest grassroots, and I think that that really resonates with people.
Honest grassroots sometimes is code word for I don't have a lot of money. I mean, it takes money to run these campaigns. How are you going to raise the money here? This is a district that is not on the national radar, so you probably won't have the DCCC sweeping in and doling you out thousands and thousands of dollars to go buy campaign ads. How are you going to get people to give you the money you need to run this campaign?
No, you're absolutely right. That is maybe a little bit of a code word there. But I don't think that it's necessary to raise the kind of money that you often see in congressional campaigns. You know, I certainly don't need millions of dollars in order to win this seat. What I need is organization. So really what it's about is actually organizing people together. You know, you talk about the most expensive things that people do in these campaigns. It's normally the political ads on TV. Well, those are also the things that have been waning the most in their effectiveness. And yet it's still just part of the common idea of how you win, but we're playing a very different game, social media heavy and volunteer heavy. And I think that that's how we can do this. But as far as the money goes, we're actually doing really well with collecting just from the small donations. You know, a similar kind of feel is what we saw from Bernie Sanders' campaign, where it's mostly small donations, but from a large amount of people.
So how do you organize folks? Obviously, when you get together with like-minded people, the DFL, you got a lot of people who want to help you out. There's a great opportunity. But once that convention is over with, you've got to reach out to a lot more people. How are you reaching out to organize more folks beyond the core folks who are at the DFL?
Yeah, well, it's you always have to do the door knocking and the phone banking. Those are incredibly important aspects. But one of the things that we're trying to roll out, and this is actually the first I've said anything to the media so far, we're trying to roll out something called Todd Squads. A little bit of a silly name, but we think it's fun. And the idea is to actually give agency to people who want to volunteer. So it's not about always getting the direction from us. It's really bottom-up kind of politics. And that's the kind of campaign that I want to run, and that's the kind of lawmaker that I want to be. I want it to be something where everyone feels that they have a voice. So the whole idea of the Todd Squad is to just give more agency to people and allow them to kind of build their own volunteer organizations, which is really important in a place like CD6 because, well, it's a very large district.
Todd's Squad, I guess, I want to get the wording right there. So,
yep,
I mean, not
Todd
doing anything
good.
Not doing anything goofy by giving people badges or anything like that to be part of Todd Squad. Or how does one become part of Todd Squad, and how do you identify somebody else who's on Todd Squad?
Well, it's not rolled up quite yet, but it will be as simple as going to my website and signing up. Just one person, three of their friends. Todd Squad has to be at least four people, but there's really no limit to their size. And there will be a little bit of friendly competition that goes on within it, but no, it doesn't need to get too goofy. It's really about just volunteering and building up community. You know, one of the things that we want to have happen with this is oftentimes, you know, after a campaign is done, then the volunteers just go right back to the way they were and no real community's been built. I'm hoping that Todd Squad can kind of change that, where the community doesn't disappear after November.
Now, a lot of people, that may be the first time that they're meeting you here, and we talked a little bit about this before, but why don't you tell folks what your background is? This is obviously your first campaign running for Congress, but have you been involved in politics before?
Well, not directly, no. For me, it's always been an intense interest in it. So I've definitely studied a lot into it, but my background is military. I'm an Air Force veteran. I just got out at the end of last year, and well, I wasn't done serving, so I'm here to keep on serving the people of CD6.
Okay. So your military background, we've obviously mentioned some of the big issues here, which, you know, are the taxes and those types of things. What do you think is going to be the issue that is going to put you over the top over Tom Emmer? Because there has to be something that's going to help you break through.
Yeah, I do think that the big one is the money out of politics. There's not a lot of politicians talking about it right now, but you are starting to see the shift. And you can see it when you hear things like Kamala Harris talking about how she's not going to take the corporate money anymore. I've also heard that's something that Cory Booker said. And these are people who have taken a decent amount of money from corporations in the past, but they're changing their tune. And I think it's because they really realize that that's the big shift that people want to see in Washington. You look at the polls and you see that there's about 93% of the population supports getting rid of the money in politics. It's absolutely shocking that we haven't been able to get that done already. The only reason is, well, they don't want to. They like the money that they're receiving. It's a little bit of corruption, and we're going to clear that out. We need politicians who are going to talk about it. I think that that's really the big one. But really, it's more than just a single issue. It's about engaging a lot of different issues.
One of those issues, I think, is immigration. I know that we've heard from, you know, local leaders. There's been some anti-immigrant sentiment in the 6th Congressional District, and I know that probably doesn't represent the majority of folks there, but it does represent a certain segment. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with the folks who are, you know, who are concerned about that the United States is being taken over by Muslims who are coming from, you know, coming in and they're going to impose Sharia law? I'm going to the extreme there on some of the arguments that people use, but this is what some folks are saying.
Oh yeah, I honestly feel like that was the main topic that the gubernatorial candidates on the Republican side were talking about for quite a while. And it does seem to be a big topic, but like you said, I don't think that that's the majority by any stretch of the imagination. I don't want anyone to be under the impression that I'm, you know, simply going to ignore their concerns about this. But the reality is there's not much to fear about accepting immigrants into our country. We are a country built on immigration, and I think that we really need to respect that fact. More to the point, the best way to move forward here is education and really making sure that communities are built together and not built through division.
Okay. Good point. I don't have the exact statistics, but I believe Donald Trump won the 6th Congressional District. I think that's the case. I know he didn't win the state.
You would
but
be
the
right.
He did win the 6th Congressional District. So doing the math says that some of those folks that voted for Donald Trump, you need to convince to vote for you. Do you have a plan on that?
Yeah, well, I think Donald Trump has kind of convinced a lot of them not to to vote for me, to vote for something else. You know, I think that that's abundantly clear. For example, well, there's a lot of libertarians who vote within Minnesota, and especially when you talk about getting the money out of politics, that's something that really resonates with a lot of the libertarian voters here. But That's one aspect, but another big part is one of the problems that we experienced in 2016 was low voter turnout. Mm-hmm. So it's not purely about switching some people's votes. It's about bringing people into the fold who have never voted before, and certainly the people who decided not to vote in 2016 who might have voted in the past. I think the movements we have, especially within the high schools, there's a lot of young people who are much more interested in politics today than they were in 2016, and that's the kind of thing that's going to push us over that edge.
Some of the problem with people not turning out is, I think the last election, and we've talked about this a lot on the show, was about voting against something instead of voting for something. How do you get people to turn out? What are you going to give them to vote for? What's the message, the positive message that's going to get them excited to come out and actually vote, as opposed to, well, it doesn't matter what I do, I'm going to sit on my hands?
Yeah, well, I really don't like to, provide the doom and gloom whenever I go out. You know, I want people to be positive. It's something that I say at the town halls that I throw, if there's anything that you get from me at the end of this, is that I want you to have the hope that we can do something, that we can fix our nation. Because a lot of people are under the impression that it is very broken, and I think that they're absolutely right. So we have to talk about the things that are broken within it, and how do we fix it? You know, I've said money out of politics several times, so let me switch to something else. Single-payer health care, that's a huge issue, especially here in a rural area. You know, folks often say that, the rural Democrats are just, they want to go for Republican light. I don't think that's the case at all. If anything, they're more economically progressive, especially when it comes to things like getting the health care that they need. So that's a message that really resonates, and it's all about hope.
We're speaking with Ian Todd. He is the DFL-endorsed candidate, the newly minted endorsed candidate for CD6 to run against Tom Emmer. I got to ask you about the issue we were talking about last segment, which is guns. And there's been gridlock here, obviously, in Minnesota over this, although, as we were talking, there may be some motion moving here to actually get some bills that people might be able to vote on, doing some background checks and things. At the congressional level, it's been hopelessly deadlocked. What do you tell people when they ask you about what you're going to do about the gun problem that we have in the United States?
Well, if the blue wave does manifest the way that we're seeing it, then I think that gridlock is going to come to a very sudden end. But let's say that it doesn't. I have a reform plan that's really about the common sense aspects, and I don't think that it's an easy thing to argue against. It's a simple three-part plan. At the risk of repeating all this again, because I might have said it last time, it's about expanding the background checks and closing the loopholes. It's about getting rid of the Dickey Amendment so the CDC can study gun violence again. And it's about moving away from paper catalog systems for gun sales and move to electronic cataloging systems for gun sales.
Sounds simple enough. And then, part of this, though, is speaking to the voter. And there's a lot of there's a certain segment of the population, I think, that you're never going to be able to talk about this. But there's the movable middle, the folks who are saying something does need to be done. How do you reach out to them and say, yeah, we're not going to take away your guns. We are going to do this responsibly. We're going to do something that's going to make things better as opposed to making things worse.
Yeah, I think the best thing that we can do in situations like that is make it clear that we are reaching out to the responsible gun owners. I know a lot of the fear is that the Democrats don't know what they're talking about whenever they talk about firearms at all. Well, I'm a veteran. Now, that doesn't make me an expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I am more than willing to talk to experts, people who actually understand a lot more about firearms than I do or may ever will, and speak to them about what are the best ways of moving forward and finding a solution that doesn't get rid of people's guns, because certainly that's not what I'm after, and I don't know of anyone seeking office that is after that. So got to change the conversation, make sure people understand, what are the Democrats about? It's not getting rid of guns. It's about safety.
So I'm going to give you here 30 seconds. Your best elevator pitch, door knock pitch, what would it be to people?
All right. Well, we need a change in this country. We have seen dangerous politics time and time again. So what we really need is a political system that actually works for people. And that's what I want to provide to you, real representation. And that means listening to you over corporate interests. That means figuring out the solutions to the problems that affect you, not the problems that are affecting multinational corporations.
All right. That was almost 30 seconds. Pretty darn good. His name is Ian Todd. He is running for Congress in the 6th Congressional District. You can find more about his positions on a lot of different issues over at iantoddforcongress.com. Ian, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Mike.
We're going to take a break here, folks, but when we get back, bad news for the Trump administration. We'll dig into the details next here on the Mike McEntee Show.
Victor's 1959 Cafe in South Minneapolis is a locally owned and operated restaurant offering traditional Cuban food. Open for breakfast and lunch daily with dinner Tuesday through Saturday. For night shift workers, Victor's even has both a morning and evening happy hour, and Victor's now accepts dinner reservations too. Stop in and try some delicious, authentic Cuban cuisine like ropa vieja and seafood paella. Make your reservation and learn more at victors1959cafe.com. Victor's 1959 Cafe, revolutionary Cuban cooking.
Hi, friends. I've been talking to you about Minnesota's first green cemetery, Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens. It's an entirely new way of looking at our last earthly step. Burials are designed to have as little impact on the environment as possible. For many of us, a continuation of the commitment we made during our lifetimes. Let me suggest you go to the website, mngreengraves.com. Explore what it is. Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens. It's a lovely place, a peaceful place. Minnesota's first green cemetery.
Did you know that tooth decay is the most common disease in America? And that over half the American population has some form of periodontal disease? Simply brushing and flossing don't seem to be enough. The abundant bacteria in your mouth thrive off sugar to produce acid and plaque. But what if you could actually prevent bacteria from converting sugar into the harmful byproducts responsible for tooth decay and periodontal disease? Daily Dental Care is a life sciences company that leverages our microbiology expertise to create oral care products that promote strong teeth, healthy gums, and fresh breath. Our lozenges safely and effectively neutralize harmful bacteria and their disease-causing byproducts like acid and plaque, without harming health-promoting bacteria that guard your mouth against the destruction that sugar causes. Supplement your daily dental hygiene routine with our convenient dental lozenges. Go to dailydentalcareswithans.com or Amazon to purchase and use promo code DDC95001 at checkout for a 25% discount on your first purchase.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Daily Dental Care lozenges are not intended to replace daily dental hygiene practices.
Hey, it's Mike McEntee back here on AM 950. Hey, so much for that bromance. For the last 2 days, we've been seeing pictures of French President Emmanuel Macron palling around with President Donald Trump. Epic handshakes and jokes. But today, Macron let a joint session of Congress know that he thought nationalism and isolationism, two things that Trump has been pushing with his Make America Great campaign, were a threat to global prosperity. And then he took on Trump's climate change skepticism and pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accords.
By polluting the oceans, not mitigating CO2 emissions, and destroying our biodiversity, we are killing our planet. Let us face it, there is no planet B. On this issue, it may happen we have disagreements between the United States and France. It may happen, like in all families. But that's, for me, a short-term disagreement. On the long run, we will have to face the same realities, and we're just citizens of the same planet. So we will have to face it. So beyond some short-term disagreements, we have to work together with business leaders and local communities. Let us work together in order to make our planet great again and create new jobs and new opportunities while safeguarding our Earth.
You got to love the little dig there, make our planet great again. Republicans did stand up and applaud Macron, but they were a little bit uncomfortable, as you might expect on something like that. Other bad news for the Trump administration, other than that the bromance is apparently over with, Dr. Ronnie L. Jackson, the White House physician nominated to lead the Department of Veterans Affairs, provided a large supply of Percocet, a prescription opioid, to a White House military officer staff member, throwing his own medical staff into panic when the medical unit could not account for the missing drugs. This is according to a summary of questionable deeds compiled by the Democratic staff of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. The new details came as White House officials on Wednesday ratcheted up their public defense of Dr. Jackson, calling charges of workplace misconduct leveled against him outrageous, even as these new incidents surfaced. That hearing still not rescheduled yet. And the other, another head, or at least embattled head, approved head, I should say already, Scott Pruitt, who's in charge of the EPA these days, he's preparing to testify to Congress tomorrow about a series of spending and ethics violations. An internal EPA document indicates that he is going to spend a lot of time blaming his staff for many of the decisions that have put a cloud over his tenure. I'm not sure how that is going to work with in terms of giving close aides to work for him in Oklahoma a substantial pay raise and a lot of other things, including buying stuff at, you know, like a phone booth and spending thousands of dollars on it. All going to be interesting. So, you know, you'll want to tune in to the EPA hearing at the at Congress tomorrow. That is it for today's show. We'll be keeping an eye on the legislature. We'll let you know what happens with the gun legislation tomorrow that Senator Latz is going to offer. You can watch that live over at theuptake.org. It's Mike McEntee. I'll be back here tomorrow. And hey, Mom, thank you for listening.